Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. This program is devoted to the largest and fastest growing segment of society. To those of you who, like me, have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, that they are actually counterproductive. If you would like to join us in this discussion anytime over the next 2 hours, you're welcome. Toll free 877-300-7645. The story begins Dateline Bethlehem in what is called the West Bank. It's interesting, isn't it, that Bethlehem, that was part of Judea for many thousands of years, and Judea, of course, is one of the 12 provinces of Israel, all of Israel, would be called Bethlehem, the West Bank, in politically correct periodicals. This is from the Washington Post. Not Bethlehem, Israel. And it's amazing. I mean, Bethlehem is, what, 5 miles south-southwest of Jerusalem, the capital of not only the province of Judea, but of the country of Israel. That it was Israel way back in the time of Abraham. That was the promised land. This would be 2000 BCE, 400 years later, when the children of Israel were brought back from slavery in Egypt, it was still Israel, Israel. And what, that's around 1500 BCE. David, the great king, known as Dod in the text, he founded the city of Jerusalem based upon what Abraham had done there with Yahweh in terms of establishing the covenant on Mount Moriah. He cleared and prepared the area for the Temple Mount, where the first temple would stand. Solomon then completing that temple at right around 1000 BCE, laying the cornerstone in 968 BCE. Jerusalem, Israel, the name of the country, Israel, Israel, its capital city, Jerusalem. And it's the only place that Yahweh has said, this is my country. This is my city. This is the city from which I will affirm the covenant. This is the city which I will affirm the Moed Mikra, the invitations to meet. This is the city which I will reside. This is the city where my home on earth will be established in his temple. This is the city upon which I will return in the country that is named after my people, Israel. And yet in a periodical, whether it be the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, no matter the source, the BBC, Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is it's a Hebrew word. Beth means family and home. And it is the, you know, family and home of Yahweh. And here, we can't even refer to it as Israel. And think about West Bank. What West Bank means is that this is on the west side of the Jordan River. It was, prior to 1948, it was part of Jordan. And so, did the Jordanians refer to it as the West Bank? No. You know, even Gaza wasn't referred to as Gaza prior to 1948. It was part of Egypt. Did Egypt call it Gaza? Did, when Egypt controlled all of Gaza, was there any call to give a mythical people, a people who have assumed the name Palestinian, not realizing that the last of the Palestinians, the Philistines, were killed by the Assyrians, wiped out entirely over 2,500 years ago? Why wasn't there a cry to give these wannabe people their own homeland in Gaza? The Egyptians had no interest in doing it. The world didn't cry for it. The world didn't say that Gaza was occupied by the Egyptians. No, it was just part of Egypt. And the people living there were Arab Muslims. And, of course, what we refer to now as the West Bank was part of Jordan. There was no cry to establish a Palestinian state there. There were no Palestinians. The moniker Palestinian wasn't even used to describe the people. The only reference to Palestine was in scholastic circles, because scholastic circles like to impress one another, those who participate in it, with their use of Latin nomenclature. And the name Philistina for what is now called Palestine is Latin. It's a Latin transliteration of the name of the Philistines. Now, the Philistines weren't in the West Bank. And the Philistines as a people no longer exist. They were literally wiped out. There is no trace of them. There is no history apart from Yahweh's Torah. No history apart from the Torah and the writings of Yahweh in what Christians would call the Old Testament, but in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Apart from the Torah and Prophets and Psalms, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever of the Philistines. So if there really was a Philistine, then the only place you can credit would be Yahweh's Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And yet if you credit Yahweh's Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, you can't justify giving the promised land to Muslims. And yet without the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, there are no Philistines. And there's no connection between the Philistines of old and the Palestinians of today. Palestinians have no ancestry that dates back, no politics that date back. There's no identity whatsoever. They just took the name upon themselves to fool people, to create this myth that the land was theirs and that they belonged there and that it was stolen from them. And the myth prevails because most people are ignorant and irrational. Now, the fact is that the name, the Latin name, transliterating the old Philistines of old, Philistia, that became Palestine, only existed because Hadrian, probably in the top five of most repulsive men who ever lived, Hadrian, when he came up with the plan of wiping Israelis out and wiping the province of Judea off the face of the map, he came up with this plan that he would lure Israelis back to Israel, to what the Romans called the province of Yehudah, by promising that the Romans would rebuild the very temple that they had destroyed some 70 years earlier. In 70 CE, they destroyed it. Hadrian is back around 132 to 133 CE. And he invites all the Jews back from all the various places that they were scattered after the Romans annihilated the place in 70 CE and said, come on back, we'll rebuild the Temple Mount. They all come back. And he says, oh, I forgot to let out one little detail that you might find interesting here. Now that you're all back, I'm not going to build a temple to your God, Yahweh. No. I'm going to build a temple to myself. The statues in that temple will be to me presented as God. And while I'm at it, I'm also going to build monstrous temples to Jupiter as God. And in addition to that, I'm going to create Roman forums on the Temple Mount and throughout central Jerusalem. And I'm going to put in barracks, because the whole purpose of my new city, which we're going to name after me, after Hadrian, the purpose of this is to make it a vacation spot for Roman legions. So since my support is from the legions, I'm going to build this city as a vacation place for the legionaries. And while they're here, they can go to the Temple Mount and into this giant temple, and they can choose between me and Jupiter. And, of course, the Yehudim revolted, which is what Hadrian expected. And he had three legions of Roman troops there. And there was one of the most gruesome battles of all time. And after the Romans finally prevailed and crucified hundreds of thousands of Jews, after they starved Jews to death, after they completely destroyed the place and salted the earth as they had to Carthage previously, Hadrian then said, you know, what we're going to do is, this has always been, and it has been since longer than Rome has even existed as an empire. In fact, for three times longer, four times longer than Rome has existed as an empire, this has been the province of Yehuda. We're going to change the name. We're not only going to haul more Jews away to slavery, we're going to change the name of the place, and we're going to call Yehuda Philistina, after the long extinct enemy of Israel. And so to buy into the myth that there is a place called Palestine, and that it's coterminous with the borders of Israel, and that it should replace Yehuda, you have to be wholly ignorant of history, or you're irrational, or you just have an agenda where the truth gets in your way. And so this idea that it was Bethlehem, the West Bank, is absolutely stupid. I'm sorry, there's no other word for it. It's just stupid. Now, that wasn't the reason I came to this story. I wanted to share with you the way the story reads from the periodical, but when you read lies to the extent of Bethlehem West Bank, it requires clarification. This story begins on Monday. Maysoon Musa. Now, Musa, of course, is the Arabic variation of Moses, who's really Moshe. And the reason that Muslims use that name is because in the Quran, Allah claims that Moses was a Muslim prophet. Now, of course, if you have read what is known about Moses, 100% of what's known about him is found in the Torah, which Yahweh revealed through him, you would know that Yahweh says that when he introduces himself to Moses, that he says, my name is Yahweh. That is the only name. My one and only name is the only name I ever want to be called and known as. And he says that any other name is the name of a false god. So his god most certainly was not Allah. We'll be back in a moment. Well, the story begins on Monday. Maysoon Musa rose early for morning prayers. Now, even as we get past Musa, recognizing that if you know anything about Moses, whose real name is Moshe, it means to draw out, then you know that Moshe spoke for, was inspired by, a god whose name was Yahweh, who said that a god by any other name is a false god, that I have only one name. If you want to refer to me, I will only respond to one name, and that is Yahweh. So for Muslims to claim that Moshe was a Muslim prophet is to say that they are wholly ignorant of who Moshe actually was, what he did, who he worked with, who inspired him, and what he wrote in the Torah. And beyond that, of course, the Torah, which is credited to Moshe as the scribe. Yahweh speaks in first person throughout it, with exception of Devarim. And Devarim, Moshe is doing the thing that I enjoy the most, which is, after you listen to what Yahweh has to say, you study what he has written, you examine it, which means to observe. You closely examine and carefully consider what he has written, that then you make connections and you apply these the teaching and the guidance. And so the Devarim, which is Hebrew for words, it's been corrupted to Deuteronomy in a transliteration of the Greek, as if Moshe wrote in Greek. He didn't. He wrote in Hebrew. And Devarim is the Hebrew word, is the plural of Debar, which is the Hebrew word for word. And so what Moshe did in Devarim is he came up with this interpretation, if you will, the application, the commentary or the insights that were available to him based upon someone who had listened to Yahweh, who had examined what Yahweh had to say, how we'd apply that to our lives. Excuse me a moment. I have a frog in my throat, and it's certainly quieting down and going away. And so Devarim is the only part of the Torah where Moshe is speaking in first person throughout, and he's only speaking about one thing. He's sharing what Yahweh conveyed. It's sort of like, for those of you who have read Intro to God.org or have read yadayah.com, what you find is that I will translate and amplify Yahweh's words, what he had to say, and then I will write a paragraph or two of commentary on how this applies, how this fits within science, within history, how this is connected to something else that God will say, how we come to know the accurate definition of these words based upon their usage throughout the other places in the Torah. And so the commentary exists very much like the Devarim exists to help us think about, ponder, to examine, to consider, to benefit from, to be enlightened by Yahweh's testimony. And so, well, the Devarim is inspired and my words are not. It's the same concept here. So it is a concept, by the way, because here we have morning prayers. Do you know how many times either Yahweh or Moshe told us to pray in the Torah? But John, you're listening to the show. I know that you're not a guy that probably spends a lot of time in the Torah. But since prayer seems to be such a big part of religion, since Islam claims that the Torah was inspired by its God, and since Muslims pray three times a day, this is the morning prayer, and they, you know, do those five prostrations three times a day, you would assume that therefore Yahweh or Moshe would have really insisted that we pray a lot. Do you know how many times that Yahweh asks us to pray in the Torah?
I do not know. What's the numbers?
Okay, well, take a guess. What would be if, since Islam has said that it's based on the Torah, and that Muslims pray 3 to 5 times a day, and they do multiple prayers each of those times a day? Would you, wild guess, how many times do you think, and you know, the religious Jews may spend all their time bobbing up and down, you know, they do the minions, which means they gather with 10 of them, and they bob up and down and recite their prayers at the Western Wall. So a lot of praying going on there. Christians, you know, that Paul wrote, pray without ceasing. So you want to venture a guess as to how many times Yahweh encourages us to pray?
Let's do 28.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we return. It's only off by 28. So the number is either 56 or 0. Which one do you think it might be, John? I'm going with 0. It's counterintuitive, isn't it? It actually makes total sense if you can pull yourself away from religion and our indoctrination about religion, that God wouldn't say, would be uninterested in us yabbering to him. In fact, it seems intuitive that if God, who in this case, whose name is Yahweh, not in just in this case, it's in every case, his name is Yahweh, provided some guidance and instruction to us, if he put out an invitation for us to come to know him, if he introduced himself to us, that it would be appropriate, considering our relative status between us and God, for us to listen to him, to come to know him based upon what he has conveyed before we start yabbering at him. You know, this idea of the Christian, you know, I want this, I want that. God, take care of my country, take care of my family, take care of me and my job, take care of me with my dating interest. You know, I'd really like to win the lottery. Us just yabbering at a God that we haven't even bothered to get to know, God finds repulsive. And says so. That's what we ought to expect. But in terms of the bowing down thing, which is the, in addition to that, you know, the Christian bowing down is something else that's intuitive if you think about who God is. And if we were to put ourselves in his role, we would come up with the same concept. Right? So the answer to the question, how many times God asks us to pray to him in the Torah, is in fact 0. never once asks us to do so. He constantly, though, asks us of our own free will to observe what he has written down for us in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And to observe means not to do. It doesn't mean to obey. Observe is a verb that means to closely examine and carefully consider. So in the case of written text, you read it and then you think about it. And he asks us constantly to listen to him. So once you've observed what he has to say and you've listened to him, you've come to know him and you understand what he has to offer, then respond by all means. But don't give him your laundry list of, I want this, I want that, I've fallen ill, or somebody's fallen ill, so I'm going to talk to you for the first time and tell you to fix them. It's ridiculous. Now, on the bowing down thing, Scott and I had a, it's not Scott, it's John too, today. John and I had an opportunity to talk during the break. And so I said, John, if you were to create your own little farm, and you were raising slugs, and you thought that it'd be really fun to train slugs to burp out that John is the greatest, John is wonderful, oh, John, I love you. What would that say about you, John?
It's basically just egotistical kind of, hey, everyone, stroke my ego. I need it, you know.
Yeah. It would say that, it would say that you're insecure. It would say that that you have a deep-seated lack of personal comfort with yourself. You need to be told you're wonderful because you've got a deep-seated void.
Exactly.
Now imagine God's gone a little bit further than just collecting and training slugs. He actually created the environment where we can live and conceive life. Now, can you imagine a God capable of that, being insecure and saying, because, you know, the reason I did all of this is I want my creation to worship me and to tell me how wonderful I am? Multiple times a day?
It just doesn't make sense, yeah.
No. And can you imagine, okay, as a dad, can you imagine a dad telling his children, kids, what we do every time that we meet is you get down on your knees and you prostrate yourself. You bow down to me every time we meet. I want you on your knees. I want you bowing down to me.
That would be a crazy person, yes.
That would be a crazy person. But what if you were a dad? Wouldn't you want to, and you have a child, a son or a daughter, wouldn't you want to get down on your knees to lift your son and daughter up and do everything you can to lift them up?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And would it be possible? Have you ever seen a young child, say a three-year-old, lift up their dad?
Can't say I have, no.
No, in fact, it would be counterproductive, wouldn't it? It would squish them. Yeah, it would not be odd, but if a three-year-old tried to lift up their dad, you'd end up probably hurting the dad and killing the three-year-old.
Right.
Okay? His whole idea is this Ba'eth family that he wants to establish. And do you think that, you're a pretty capable guy, John. Do you think that you'd be capable of lifting up God?
I don't believe so.
No, probably not. I know I can't, so I'm not going to even try because it's counterproductive. He wants to lift us up. I think he's fully capable of doing that.
I agree.
So one of the things we talked about during the break is that everything about Yahweh, as he describes himself in his Torah, is the opposite of religion, isn't it?
It's the inverse of it, absolutely. Yeah,
it's the inverse. You know, religion wants you on your knees lifting up God, and God wants to get on his knees to lift us up.
Which is very, backwards, yeah.
Right. Religions want you praying to God, and God wants you listening to him. It's just the opposite all the way through. And it's opposite because the religious God's not God. And the real God's not insecure. So the real God's worth knowing. The religious God, no. He's, can you imagine a father that says, I want you to fear me?
Abusive father, yeah.
Abusive father. So why do religions say that we ought to fear God?
Well, yeah. I think we know why, yeah.
Yeah. Because if you fear the religious God, guess whom has who has complete control over you?
It's very convenient, yeah.
Yeah. The religion. If the Roman Catholic Church tells you, falsely, by the way, that they hold the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and that The only way to get there is to be a member of their church and to go to their confession and to attend their Eucharist and to donate money to them and be in good standing with them is the only way that they will use their keys to heaven and preclude you from going to hell. If you believe them, they have a lot of power over you, don't they?
Absolutely. That is the point, yeah.
That is the point. And so all religions are conceived to give men power over the masses. That's the basis. And it's why the first requirement that God has, if you want to engage in a relationship with him, he has a prerequisite and then four additional requirements. And the prerequisite is walk away from Babel. Walk away from religion and politics and patriotism. Disassociate with all of that phony stuff that's designed to constrain the liberty of men and women. Because I don't want that gunk in my home. It's all false. It's all trashy. It's all designed to manipulate. It's all inverted. The inverse of the truth. So here we are on this story. The inverse of the truth is Bethlehem, West Bank. The inverse of the truth is that Musa, was somehow associated with Islam, a religion that wouldn't even exist for 2,000 years thereafter. The notion that you should rise for morning prayers is also the inverse of the truth. Anyway, she was out there helping to harvest squash from one of the family fields. So that, by the way, is extraordinarily unusual. Most of these people that have wrongly ascribed the term Palestinian to them, because there are no Palestinians alive anywhere in the world and haven't been for 2,500 years, they don't work. They're complete and total dependence. That's why America and countries around the world provide so much economic aid, because most of these so-called Palestinians don't work. I'm not saying that from just to be mean. I've been there. I've driven through the streets of Bethlehem. I've had the only thing that is an activity that goes on in Bethlehem, because all of the stores, all of the shops are shuttered, is that men sit on the street corners, and most of the young men are armed with AK-47s. They do not work. And so this idea that in Bethlehem, which is a fairly heavily populated area, not much room for fields, that a Muslim girl was out working, when Muslims aren't even supposed to leave their home if they're not accompanied by a male family member, is extraordinarily odd. But anyway, she was, we are told to believe that she was out harvesting squash in the family fields. She acted perfectly normal, said her mother, who described her daughter as just a quiet girl, as shy as a chicken. Then the 19-year-old university student, so this little girl was not too little, she was 19 years old. And, you know, the Obaminator would tell you that the solution for Islamic terrorism is more economic opportunity and particularly more educational opportunity. Well, here's a girl that was employed. Here's a girl that was a university student. So Obaminator, that is not the solution. She went to checkpoint 300 in Bethlehem. It's a busy turnstile through the high gray concrete wall that separates this as the Palestinian territory from in the West Bank from Israel. Now, why do you think the wall's there? Do you think the wall maybe is there because got to keep those crazy Jews in? Don't want those Jews escaping and making life horrible for these Palestinians, you know, because those Jews might carry suicide bombs. They might act as terrorists. They might go off and murder civilians. No, that's not the case, is it? So why did the wall go up? The wall went up because the so-called Palestinians are terrorists. And it's to create a modicum of safety for the Israelis. And there is no such thing as a Palestinian territory. There is no such thing as a Palestinian. If you can say Palestinian, or this, as this periodical wrote, Palestinian territory, if you can write that, and you're writing for a periodical, which means that you went to college, what it says that is that you are either so corrupt, so indoctrinated in almost a religious zeal for political correctness that you will knowingly promote a lie, or that you're so indoctrinated in political correctness that the truth is absolutely meaningless to you. It says that, you squandered your education because you were indoctrinated. You didn't bother to learn. Because there is no such thing as Palestinian territory. And even when the Philistines actually existed, they were never in any area outside of five or six communities, little villages, in what is presently called Gaza. Bethlehem was never part of their territory. So then the 19-year-old, shy as a chicken, perfectly normal girl named Maysoon Musa, the university student, went to Checkpoint 300 in Bethlehem to pass through the Palestinian territory, even though there is no such place, in the West Bank, of which there is no such place, from Israel, of which there is such a place. There, according to Israeli authorities, but you've got to know those Israeli authorities, they would be bad. We're going to tell the story of the mother just as she said it. We're not going to say according to the mother. We're not going to say according to the Islamic politicos in this mythical area known as the Palestinian territory, in the mythical area known as the West Bank. No, but when it comes to those Israelis, we're going to say they're according to those Israelis. Double standard going on here. Musa removed a curved dagger from her bag. And then she stabbed and wounded a female Israeli in the neck. The victim was Liron Yisraeli. She was 19 years old. The assault a few miles south of Jerusalem's old city was one of seven major attacks against Israelis in the quote-unquote occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem just over the 2 weeks of Ramadan. The pace and mixed style of violence, ambushes, stabbings, and drive-by shootings have broken a month period of relative calm as Muslims celebrated their holy month. Yes, let's go out and be religious by slicing someone's neck. Let's go off and be religious by doing a drive-by shooting and killing someone we do not know. Let's go off and celebrate Ramadan through an ambush. That's all, of course, Islamic. The Quran says, lay in wait for non-Muslims. It says to smite them on their necks. It says to incapacitate them. It says to kill them wherever they are, whenever you find them. So all of this is wholly consistent with what the Quran mandates a Muslim must do. But why is it that we tolerate and apologize for such a horrid religion that would celebrate the holiest month on its calendar by these terrorist acts? Did this woman attack this other woman to see if, hey, why don't we engage? We have a difference of opinion. We've come to different conclusions. Why don't we engage in a wrestling match or a... why don't we arm wrestle? Why don't we... No, she just went up, pulled a knife, and sliced the throat of a defenseless woman. Do you think that those that were driving by were a threat to the Muslim, or the Muslim just say, you know, this is an innocent, unarmed civilian, and I've got a AK-47, let me blow them away. That's, of course, what Muhammad did. He never attacked those who could defend themselves. He only attacked civilians. That's what terrorists do, after all. But my question is, why is it considered compassionate? Why is it considered appropriate to have a coexist bumper sticker, to run cover for, to apologize for, to even support this religion when this is how Muslims are told they must behave? And it is how they are behaving. For a religion that kidnaps little girls, that turns little girls into sex slaves by the tens of thousands, and yet we apologize for it, that has murdered hundreds of thousands in the last few years as the Islamic State and before them al-Nusra rose to power. The Taliban before them. The PLO before them. What is it about us that causes us to speak harshly of those who have the wisdom and courage and compassion to denounce these kinds of doctrine that cause people to act so badly? Why are we hateful of those who expose and condemn these horrid behaviors, as opposed to instead hating that which inspires them? It's a good question, one which there isn't a very good answer, but we'll return with some very good answers.